Welcome to The Reference Desk, a podcast where two librarians take you down the rabbit hole of the topics that have bewitched us.
So adjust the chain on your reading glasses, button up your favorite cardigan, and follow us punk-ass book jockeys through the stacks to The Reference Desk.
Hello!
Welcome to The Reference Desk!
I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And welcome again.
That's the first time that we've done that in one go.
I ruined it.
No, but I think we were both so shocked that it happened that we're like, now what?
What now?
We usually have to redo that a few times.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us this evening.
Yeah, we're both very red-cheeked because it's bedtime.
It is bedtime.
And you could be seeing all of this if you join us over at Patreon.
You would be so lucky.
Yeah. Oh.
Do we have a new patron, don't we?
Ooh, yes. Melissa.
Melissa. Thank you, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa. We're so happy to have you.
Sorry that this might be the first episode you're seeing of us.
I would say that it gets better, but it has literally progressively gotten worse.
Yeah. So, So, I have a staff pick.
Yay.
And it's a really good one. I actually have like 50 pages left of this book, but I'll probably finish it tonight. And it is How to Sell a Haunted House by Grady Hendrix.
Ah, I want to read this. This is on my list.
It's so good. It's so good. So I've talked about Grady Hendrix before. We're both fans. You know, my best friend's Exorcism is probably one of my favorite books. And this one, it's very different from what he usually writes, but it's phenomenal. It's parts of it are definitely like outright horror. Like, ooh, it gets pretty scary. But there's also like this theme of grief and like how fickle our memories can be, and like family relationships. So it gets really, really deep. Mm. It has excellent character development, but it's also really horrific. And also kind of funny too. Mm-hmm, like
somehow he does it all.
Yes. It's so, so good. So it's about a woman named Louise who lives in San Francisco with her 5-year-old daughter, Poppy. And she learns that her parents have died in a tragic accident, like both of them in a car accident at the same time. Mm. So that forces her to return home. The blurb on the back of the book says she doesn't want to leave her daughter with her ex and fly to Charleston. She doesn't want to deal with her family home, stuffed to the rafters with the remnants of her father's academic career and her mother's lifelong obsession with puppets and dolls.
No thank you.
And she doesn't want to learn how to live without the two people who knew and loved her best in the world. Most of all, she doesn't want to deal with her brother Mark, who never left her hometown, gets fired from one job after another, and resents her successes. Unfortunately, she'll need his help to get the house ready for sale because it'll take more than some new paint on the walls and clearing out a lifetime of memories to get this place on the market. But some houses don't want to be sold, and their home has other plans for both of them.
Ooh, it sounds so good.
It's so good. It's really strong on like the sibling relationship and like trying to repair it, and how, you know, sometimes each sibling views their childhood completely separately. Mm-hmm. Even like raised in the same house by the same people, they're two different experiences. So it's just so good. Read it.
Yay. Ooh, that's exciting.
What about you?
Yes, I do. I have a staff pick, and it's a book this week.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. I feel like I did TV shows for a while.
Hey!
So I know that, like, everyone has already read this. I get it. I'm not hip. I don't do things quickly. But I finally did read this book, and it's really that good. So if you haven't heard about this yet on Book Talk, the book is Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabriel Zevin. Mm-hmm. And it's really good. It's really good. You do not have to be a gamer to like it. Like, I know that that's one thing I've heard that people are like, well, I don't really like video games, so I'm not going to like it. You don't have to. So very briefly, it's the story of two childhood friends who reconnect in college to build a video game together. It's a long book, like both narratively and literally. It covers 30 years.
Ooh.
And it's like over 400 pages, so it's a long one. Okay. And it's like, it's one of those books where I don't even want to say too much about it, because I feel like talking about the plot is going to make people think like, oh, I won't like that. Like, that's not for me. But it's so good, and I don't want to do that. So it's very slow. It's very sweet. You will love the characters at some points and hate them at others. You'll think that you're like cheering for one thing to happen, and then a few chapters later, you're like, nope, don't like that. Don't want that to happen. It's frustrating, and it's heartbreaking, and it's boring and monotonous in parts, and then something like absolutely terrible happens and you just want to go back to those boring parts again.
Aww.
It reads like life. Like, it just is so lifelike. And it's one of those books that like I find myself thinking about over and over again, even though I finished it weeks ago. Like, it's that good. I want to go read it again right now.
Oh.
So add definitely worth the hype.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well. We can just get into it. I'm excited about this one. Okay. So I've got a bit of a long intro. It was like real long and I've pared it down. So here we go.
Okay. I'm intrigued.
So I think it's no secret that we are not taught even a fraction of our history in this country, right?
What, Haley? What?
Yeah, I know. And those that are left out almost exclusively from the history books are, you know, predominantly people of color, women, those in the LGBTQIA plus communities, and, you know, those with disabilities.
What?
I know, shocking. And, you know, it's still happening, of course. There's, you know, so many book bans and history curriculums being torn apart. I'm looking at you, Florida. What the fuck?
Oh, my God.
Yes.
So, so thankful that I'm not a teacher in Florida anymore.
It's horrendous.
Or a librarian.
Yes.
Just, oh.
It's awful.
It is.
I feel so bad for those kids. But I think, you know, it's safe to assume, despite all of that, I think we all know who Rosa Parks is. Yes. Mm-hmm. and so we know, you know, that Rosa Parks was traveling home from her job at a nearby department store where she worked as a seamstress. She was riding on a Cleveland Avenue bus in Montgomery on December 1st, 1955. She was sitting in a seat in the front row of the segregated colored section. And the driver, J. Fred Blake, asked Rosa and three other African-American passengers to leave their seats when the white seats were full. Parks refused. She was arrested and given a $10 fine, which is about $110 today.
Oof.
And this was seemingly the final straw in a slew of injustices specifically regarding the transportation system in Montgomery, urging several political activist groups to stage what is now known as the Montgomery bus boycott. So Rosa may be one of the most taught and recognizable figures in civil rights history, but she was hardly the first to stand up against these transportation injustices. Some of us may have heard the name Claudette Colvin, who was a 15-year-old who was arrested for refusing her seat on a bus months before Rosa did it. But what about Aurelia Browder or Susie McDonald or Mary Louise Smith Ware?
Aurelia?
Yeah. You know, I was so excited that that was her name. maybe you haven't heard of Elizabeth Jennings, who preceded all of them by almost 100 years. And probably not Georgia Gilmore. There are so many important women who helped spark, motivate, organize, and sustain the civil rights movement in America. And so that is why this week I am bewitched with some of these unsung heroes fighting for transportation equality during and before the Montgomery bus boycott that sparked the civil rights movement.
Yay!
Yay!
Yes! Women. Oh, this is exciting.
Women getting stuff done.
Yes. Okay.
So I'm going to focus specifically on three women. The first is Elizabeth Jennings. That's not her. That's a horse.
That's a horse.
What happened to Elizabeth?
Excuse me, ma'am.
There she is. Okay. there's Elizabeth. This is the only known photo of her. Her story takes us to 1861. So if you listen to the Day in the Life of a Victorian episode, you'll know that transportation during this time was either unheated trains with no lights or the horse-drawn omnibus, which
is
on
omnibus.
This picture. The omnibus. So these were essentially large horse-drawn carriages or stagecoaches. They could carry around 20 passengers inside and then another 16 on top. No, thank you.
So bizarre.
But by the 1850s, the horse-drawn streetcar on rails was a much more popular mode of transportation. You can see that in this photo here of New York City. Ooh. Yeah, so they were on the rails. They had railed streetcars.
This is like the trolley at Disney World.
Yeah. but these streetcars were owned by private companies. And even though Manhattan was home to America's largest black population at that time, these buses were often segregated by race with very arbitrary rules. Buses that allowed black passengers would have large signs reading colored passengers allowed, but others, it was up to passenger choice, meaning that if a white person didn't want a black person on the stagecoach or what a streetcar, they could just kick them off.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So on Sunday, July 16th, 1854, here's Miss Elizabeth again. She was running late to the first Colored Congregational Church, which was in New York City, and she was the organist there. She decided to catch a ride on one of the Third Avenue Railroad Company streetcars at the corner of Pearl Street and Chatham Street. So this particular car was one without the colored passengers allowed sign. So that meant it's up to the passengers whether she can board or not. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, just for her background, she was born in 1830 to Mother Elizabeth Cartwright and Father Thomas L. Jennings. Thomas was a free man, but Elizabeth was born enslaved. Thomas was a very successful tailor and is listed as the very first black man to hold a U.S. patent for one of his inventions.
Wow.
He developed a method of dry cleaning clothes in the 1820s.
Wow. All right.
Yeah.
Ben Wyatt would later come up with a way to sell you chemicals.
I know it's not as sexy. Oh, my. So with the money that he earned from his invention, he was able to buy his family's freedom. So though New York had passed an abolition law in 1799, it was gradual, which meant that any children born to those who were enslaved before the law took place or went into effect would not earn their freedom until males reached age 28 and females reached age 25.
Oh,
yeah.
Like the life expectancy was not that great.
No.
That did not leave you that much time.
No. No. So he was able to buy his entire family's freedom. So the Jennings family was very well connected and involved in their church and community. Elizabeth had obtained her diploma, but she had to do that in a separate ceremony because she was not able to attend commencement with the other white kiddos when she graduated from public school. But because she did have a diploma, she was able to teach, and she did that at the city's private African Free School was the name of the school. Mm-hmm. And she was also an organist for her church. When Elizabeth boarded the streetcar with her friend on Sunday, July 16th, 1854, the conductor only reluctantly let them on with the caveat that if any white passengers objected, quote, you shall go out or I'll put you out.
Just want to get to where I'm going.
Seriously, she's running late. She needs to go play the organ for church.
There is nothing worse than walking into church late, right? Especially if they're literally waiting on you to like cue the music so they can start. Oh
gosh.
Get her to church.
Yes. As she described the incident later, Elizabeth said, quote, I was a respectable person born and raised in New York, did not know where he was born, and that he was a good-for-nothing, impudent fellow for insulting decent persons while on their way to church.
Yes.
Yes. So the conductor attempted to eject her by force, because apparently he didn't like her attitude, but she resisted. She held onto the window frames, and even at one point, the conductor's coat, because she was not getting kicked off the streetcar. So after unsuccessfully removing her, though he continued to drive off and leave her friend at the curb, he saw a police officer and stopped to ask for help. The officer immediately threw Elizabeth to the sidewalk. The New York Tribune wrote about the incident saying, quote, she got upon one of the company's cars last summer on the Sabbath to ride to church. The conductor undertook to get her off, first alleging the car was full. When that was shown to be false, he pretended the other passengers were displeased at her presence. But when she insisted on her rights, he took hold of her by force to expel her. She resisted. The conductor got her down on the platform, jammed her bonnet, soiled her dress, and injured her person. Quite a crowd gathered, but she effectually resisted. Finally, after the car had gone on further, with the aid of a policeman, they succeeded in removing her.
Mm. You know, what's so scary is that, like, replace the horse-drawn carriage with, like, mm-hmm. Uber or a taxi, and that is, like, exactly something you'd read in a newspaper today.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. And this was before the Civil War. Like,
it's almost like we should, I don't know, like, learn about this stuff, so maybe we can do better in our lifetime.
But Kitty, that'll make us white folk feel so guilty we just won't be able to function.
Deserve it. Give me the guilt.
Seriously. Okay. Following the incident, prominent Black New Yorkers, including Jennings' father, started a campaign to end racial discrimination on streetcars. Frederick Douglass published her account in his newspaper, where it attracted widespread attention. Elizabeth's father filed a lawsuit on behalf of his daughter against the driver, the conductor, and the Third Avenue Railroad Company in Brooklyn. And a new lawyer, brand new lawyer, Chester A. Arthur, who would later become president, represented her. The New York Times states, quote, on February 22nd, 1855, Judge William Rockwell advised a jury in state Supreme Court that the company was required as a common carrier to convey all respectable persons, including, quote, colored persons, if sober, well-behaved, and free from disease.
Oh, that still seems entirely too subjective.
Yes, yes. The jury awarded Elizabeth damages in the amount of $250, or about $7,300 today.
That's amazing.
Yes, which was just about a year's worth of her salary.
Oof.
Yeah. And the very next day, the Third Avenue Railroad Company ordered its cars desegregated.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's and amazing.
I know. Like, she won.
Yeah. Yeah. You made me late for church, and there will be hell to pay.
Yes. Oh. So not only that, the Tribune later reported, quote, railroads, steamboats, omnibuses, and ferry boats would also be required to desegregate. Wow. So, like, she did it.
Like, the entire transportation system.
Yes. Wow. Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yes. Which was all privatized at this time, too. So, like,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
And that's one of those things that, like, you don't think about just, like, the privilege of leaving your house and knowing that you would be able to get to where you were going on time without yes. being thrown off mm-hmm. the horse bus or whatever it was. I mean.
Right. Right. Yeah. Elizabeth continued to teach for 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah, eventually for public schools. Mm-hmm. She married Charles Graham in 1860, and they had a son, though he died when he was only one.
Oh, no.
And unfortunately, this was during the draft riots, which was another thing that I had to look up because I didn't know what they were. So according to history.com, where I learned about this, the New York draft riots occurred in July 1863 when the anger of working class New Yorkers over a new federal draft law during the Civil War sparked 5 days of some of the bloodiest and most destructive rioting in U.S. history. Hundreds of people were killed, many more seriously injured, and black New Yorkers were often the target of the rioters' violence. Mm.
Never had heard of it.
Nope. No, me either. And because of this, the Grahams had to, like, sneak to their son's graveyard service because they were, you know, worried about being targeted during this whole situation.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Ugh. In 1895, Elizabeth founded what was described as the very first kindergarten for black children in her home in Manhattan.
Oh, we love a teacher.
Yes. And then she died in her home on, it just says 5/1901.
Mm-hmm.
On the 5th of some mm-hmm. month in 1901. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
She died in 1901.
She died in 1901.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's Elizabeth desegregating the transportation system in the 1800s.
Incredible.
So,
incredible. Yes. The courage that it took to first, like, knock it off the bus, but then, like, follow it, like, litigate it all the way up.
Yes.
Oh, my yeah. gosh.
Yeah. Ugh, she's amazing. And sadly, it was very hard to find information about her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Most of these women, it was very hard to find information about, which made me really... I was originally going to do just one of these women, mm-hmm. but I could not find enough information, which
wow.
was really frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So we get to do all three now because they're all great. so we're going to move forward 100 years now.
Okay.
And we're headed to the South, where essentially nothing had changed since the Civil War. and let's meet Miss Claudette Colvin. Mm. Look at her glasses. She's so cute.
Yeah, adorable.
Yes. So Claudette was born in 1939. When her father abandoned the family, her mother was unable to care for her and her sister. And so they were sent to live with their great aunt and uncle, the Colvins, on a farm in rural.
The Ridger.
But the city is, or the town is called Pine Level, Alabama.
Mm, lovely.
Yes. Claudette and her sister called their aunt and uncle their parents. They loved them very much. Their aunt and uncle took them under their wing right away. And they eventually even took their last name. Mm-hmm. When Claudette was 8, the Colvins moved to Montgomery, Alabama, which, like most of the South at the time, was very heavily segregated and under the oppressive boot of Jim Crow laws. Mm-hmm. Though this was after Brown versus Board of Education, which ruled that racial segregation in schools was unconstitutional, much of the South didn't give a shit and had refused to integrate.
Yeah. Go back and listen to our episode on the Little Rock Nine.
Absolutely. Yes.
Governor Fuckwad.
Yes. Fuckwad. Gosh. Wait, what was his real name?
I don't know.
I don't either, but I don't know if it was the same. Oh, it wasn't governor. In this story, it's the mayor, so never mind.
Okay. I tried to pronounce it like once and was like, it's not important.
Fuck one. Yeah. Who cares? Who cares about him? Okay. So Claudette attended Booker T. Washington High School, which was Montgomery's first African-American high school. And she was involved in the NAACP Youth Council. Claudette had very personal experience with the brutality and humiliation that Black people faced when they either knowingly or unknowingly defied Jim Crow laws. Mm-hmm. So she witnessed what happened to her neighbor and classmate, Jeremiah Reeves. Here's Jeremiah. Look how, like, suave he is.
Wow.
I know. And that he's a teenager.
Damn.
He is all grown up and, like...
have never looked that stylish in my life.
Seriously.
Still waiting for it to happen.
I know. Oh, this poor baby. So according to the Equal Justice Initiative, in July 1951, Jeremiah, who was a 16-year-old high school student at the time, and Mabel Ann Crowder, who was a white woman, were discovered having sex in her home. Ms. Crowder claimed that she had been raped by Jeremiah, and he was, of course, immediately arrested and taken to Kilby Prison for questioning. Mm. Police strapped the frightened boy into the electric chair and told him that he would be electrocuted unless he admitted to having committed all of the rapes on white women had reported that summer.
Oh, my God.
And so, of course, under this terrifying pressure, he falsely confessed to the charges.
No shit. I would tell you literally anything you wanted to know.
Seriously. He, of course, recanted and insisted that he was innocent. But Jeremiah was convicted and sentenced to death after a 2-day trial, which the all-white jury deliberated for less than 30 minutes. Claudette says of his execution, everyone saw the injustice, the double standards. At the time Jeremiah was on death row, Black men were saying, do not look at a white woman you see walking down the street. Cross the street and pretend you have to tie your shoes. Do not make eye contact with the white women. Mm-hmm. It's horrendous.
And for parents who are worried that this, you know, reading about these things will make their white children feel bad, like, Black children don't get a choice.
Exactly. Yes.
They don't
get
a choice.
They have to have these talks.
They have to live this. They don't have to read it in a book. They live this.
Yeah.
And
how do you think they feel?
Yeah. The only way that we have any chance of ever becoming better is to actually talk about it.
Yes. And teach our children empathy. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So Jeremiah's case was the first time that Claudette actually saw, like, the NAACP in action, because they were working tirelessly trying to get his conviction appealed. Mm-hmm. And because of this horrific incident, Claudette was determined to get the very best education, go to law school, and fight for civil rights. Mm. Like, that's what she wanted to do with her life. So just as Jim Crow made all life difficult for people of color, riding public transportation was no different. Not only was the bus system segregated, where black passengers were forced to ride in the back of the bus and to stand if a white person needed a seat, they also had to pay their fare, the same fare as everybody else, and then exit the bus and then re-enter through the doors in the rear.
Wow.
Yeah. So on March 2nd, 1953, Claudette, just 15 years old, and some classmates boarded the Highland Gardens bus on the corner of Dexter Avenue and Bainbridge Street on their way home from school. There were no other white passengers on the bus at the time, so the driver did not make them exit the bus and then go to the rear doors. He just let them walk on. And Claudette chose a seat towards the middle of the bus. Eventually, the bus began to fill, and when a white passenger was left without a seat, Claudette explains the situation in her own words. Quote, "The motorman looked up in his mirror and said, 'I need those seats. I might have considered getting up if the woman had been elderly, but she wasn't. The other three girls in my row got up and moved back, but I didn't. I just couldn't. All during February, we'd been talking about people who had taken stands. We had been studying the Constitution. I knew I had rights. I had paid my fare the same as white passengers."
Wow. Like, wow.
I know. 15.
Wow.
She says that after her classmates moved and the seats were open and available, the woman still wouldn't sit down, and she just stared at Claudette. She wanted Claudette specifically to move. Claudette says, quote, "That was the whole point of the segregation rules. It was symbolic. Blacks had to be behind whites. If she sat down in the same row as me, it meant I was as good as her." Imagine just having that, like, just because of the color of my skin, I'm better than you. Like, what the fuck?
But it's ingrained into every aspect of our society.
Of course, yeah. Ugh. It's...
No, it's maddening.
So the conductor repeatedly asked her to move, and she just stayed silent and still. Claudette says, quote, "History had me glued to the seat. I felt like Sojourner Truth was pushing down on one shoulder, and Harriet Tubman was pushing down on the other, saying, 'Sit down, girl.' Learning about those two women gave me the courage to remain seated that day. I was glued to my seat."
Oh, wow.
So the driver pulled into a transfer station and immediately called for a transit policeman. While they were waiting.
Calling the police.
Seriously. I just don't understand. Just what is it hurting? Just keep going. Like, what the fuck? So while they were waiting, more passengers boarded, including a pregnant woman named Mrs. Hamilton, who sat down next to Claudette. So when the police officer arrived, he didn't necessarily want to hassle this pregnant woman. So he turned to some black men who were sitting in the rear of the bus and said, "If any of you are not gentlemen enough to give this lady a seat, you should be put in jail yourselves." And so, of course, they promptly left. And so Mrs. Hamilton then got up, sat in the back of the bus, and Claudette was alone again. The officer came over to Claudette and said, "Aren't you going to get up?" She said, "No, sir." Claudette says, "One cop grabbed my hands and his partner grabbed the other, and they pulled me straight up out of my seat. My books went flying everywhere. I went limp as a baby. I was too smart to fight back. They started dragging me backwards off the bus. One of them kicked me. I might have scratched one of them because I had long nails, but I sure didn't fight back. I kept screaming over and over, 'It's my constitutional right.' I wasn't shouting anything profane. I never swore, not then, not ever. I was shouting out my rights."
And she was a child.
Yes. Like, and... she looks young too.
Yeah, like, she looks younger than
yes
she was.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So they dragged Claudette to the back of a police car and then handcuffed her through the open window. The officers ridiculed her the entire way to the station, calling her the N-word, making sexual jokes about her body. A 15-year-old. calling her thing and whore, a 15-year-old child. She was fingerprinted, booked, and driven straight to jail without the opportunity to make a phone call. She says that the sound of the cell door closing was the worst sound she had ever heard, and she can still remember how it sounded.
Yeah, because you have no idea if, like, obviously these people who arrested you aren't going to look out for your best interest. They're not going to protect your rights and yep. make sure that your family knows where you are.
Yeah.
Like, being 15 years old and being put in a prison cell, like, mm-hmm. you'd probably think, this is it.
Right. Right. For doing nothing except for sitting in a seat. Like,
Yeah. And again, the part that's so frustrating is that this shit is still happening. There's still, like, schools are still calling police officers mm-hmm. on children, and they're mm-hmm. being arrested and taken mm-hmm. away in police cars.
Yes. Yes. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
Her classmates who had been on the bus were actually the ones that called her mom and told her that she had been arrested. And after that, word spread very quickly. Her mother came to get her from the jail with their pastor, Reverend H.H. Johnson. Claudette says that on the way home, Reverend Johnson said, quote, "I'm so proud of you. Everyone prays for freedom. We've all been praying and praying, but you're different. You want answers the next morning. And I think you just brought the revolution to Montgomery."
Wow. Wow.
Her father stayed up all that night with his shotgun because he was so fearful of retaliation for this incident.
Of course.
Oddly, I don't know, reactions to her arrest were kind of split in her community and school. And obviously I have not lived this experience, so I can't understand the mindsets. Some were saying that she was very brave for what she did, but others were claiming that she was just making it harder for everybody else. Hmm. So through family connections, the Colvins were able to contact E.D. Nixon, who was a prominent activist in Montgomery, who was known for getting things done and helping the African-American community when they were in trouble. Nixon was able to secure a lawyer for the Colvins and arranged a committee of black leaders to meet with the police commission. Included on this committee was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., then just a 26-year-old pastor, you know, just getting into the civil rights movement, just a little baby.
Just a kid.
Yeah. And this. Kids. Yeah. and this would actually kind of be his political debut, so to speak. This was really his first big involvement in the civil rights movement. So they met with the police commission, and though the meeting was apparently mostly pleasant, and the bus company admitted that the segregation rules were misleading, as Colvin had been seated in the colored section of the bus, they still did not drop the charges on Claudette. While preparing for trial, Nixon connected Claudette with Rosa Parks, who was the secretary of the local chapter of the NAACP. And they were trying desperately to inspire young people to join the civil rights fight. Mm-hmm. Upon their first meeting, Claudette recalls Rosa saying, "You're Claudette Colvin? Oh my God, I was looking for some big old burly overgrown teenager who sassed white people. But no, they pulled a little girl off the bus."
Yup.
Yes, a little girl. So together with the NAACP, they did many things to raise money for a lawyer for Claudette. Rosa's mom baked cookies to sell. And they also signed Claudette up for Miss NAACP, which is like a little pageant. Ooh. She came in second.
Right. But,
and that secured her a cash prize. They were able to hire lawyer Fred Gray, who's on our slide here on the right. He's very handsome. Mm-hmm. So he was a brand new baby lawyer, too, and he was vowing to, quote, "destroy everything segregated I could find."
All right.
Yes. So Claudette's plan was to plead not guilty. And she was the first person to ever plead not guilty for breaking the segregation laws against a bus arrest. Yeah. So Gray knew that this was going to be an excellent opportunity to set precedent that, you know, the bus segregation laws were unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. But he also wanted to make sure that Claudette and her family knew what they were getting into. As a minor, Claudette was unable to file a lawsuit, so one of her parents would have to do this for her. Mm. And the case would definitely make the papers. He warned that people had been fired, had their houses burned, and even been lynched for a lot less. Mm. Because they're essentially, you know, challenging Jim Crow law, you know, dead on.
Right, yeah.
But Claudette and her family were certain they wanted to go through with this. So Claudette's hearing was held on March 18th, 1955. Several prominent Black leaders attended the hearing, including Joanne Robinson, who was an English professor and leader of Montgomery's women's political group, who months before Claudette was arrested, had set up meetings and written letters to the mayor regarding the unfair treatment of Black people on city buses and was really itching to do something about it. Testimony was heard from one of the arresting officers, and a letter was read that had been written by a white passenger witness saying that the officers were, quote, gentlemen, almost to the point of turning the other cheek.
What the
speaking,
fuck?
Yeah. Speaking in tones so soft that I doubt if any of the passengers aboard the bus even heard them. I'm so sure.
That tracks. Because that sounds accurate.
If it's one thing we know cops to be, it's calm and collected, mm-hmm, right?
Gentle. Soft-spoken, never overreact.
Oh. Claudette's lawyer, Fred Gray, had her classmates who were on the bus at the time also testify their experience, which... you know, was of a young teenage girl being confronted with two white police officers on a packed bus. Mm-hmm. So very scary, and I'm sure not calm.
Yeah, and then physically dragged away.
Yes. Yeah. Judge Hill delivered his ruling not long after the case ended, and Claudette was found guilty of all charges, including violating the segregation law, disturbing the peace, and assaulting a police officer.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. This poor, sweet baby angel on here. Yeah. She assaulted a police officer. she was sentenced to probation, declared a ward of the state, and released to the custody of her parents. Mm. Joanne Robinson, who I spoke about earlier, said of the verdict, after the verdict was read, quote, Claudette's agonized sobs penetrated the atmosphere in the courthouse. Many people brushed away their own tears.
Mm. You're 15 and now... Mm-hmm. Mm-mm. Does that say put on indefinite probation?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
You know, just whenever we feel like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I also had to cover up the N-word because no thank you.
Oh, my God.
On the headline of the newspaper. Yeah. So, of course, Claudette was heartbroken. She was... worried now that with this criminal record, she was not going to be able to fulfill her dream of becoming a civil rights lawyer.
Sure.
She says, I cried a lot and people saw me cry. They kept saying I was emotional, which of course she was. She's 15.
She's 15 and she just did the bravest thing possible.
Yeah. Yeah. She said that everywhere she went, people pointed and whispered. Students at her school were turning against her. Joanne Robinson wrote, the verdict was a bombshell. Blacks were as near a breaking point as they had ever been. Resentment, rebellion, and unrest were evident in all circles. Mm. For a few days, large numbers refused to use the buses. Complaints streamed in from everywhere. The question of boycotting came up again and loomed in the minds of thousands of Black people. On paper, the Women's Political Council had already planned for 50,000 notices calling people to boycott the buses. Only the specifics of time and place had to be added. But some members were doubtful. Some wanted to wait. The women wanted to be certain the entire city was behind them, and opinions differed where Claudette was concerned. Some felt she was too young to be the trigger that precipitated the movement.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot. It's a lot to carry.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Many thought that Claudette just wouldn't be a good fit for other reasons. Some very not good reasons. Mm. They said that she, you know, her family was not well off. They didn't run in the same elite social circles. And Claudette also had made the decision to stop having her hair chemically straightened. Mm-hmm. And so it was what she described as a more African style, mm-hmm. which was kind of the opposite of what other girls at the time were doing. And then she became pregnant out of wedlock, and there was no way that they were going to let her become the face of the movement after that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
So just 9 months after Claudette had been arrested, Rosa Parks refused her seat on the same Montgomery bus line, and she effectively became the face of the Montgomery bus boycott. Mm-hmm.
So that was, that was orchestrated.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Claudette just did it because she thought that was what was right.
That's right. All right.
Later, Claudette said that another reason she believes they chose Rosa over her was, quote, "Her skin texture was the kind that people associate with the middle class. Mm. She fits the profile. Mm-hmm. They wanted someone, I believe, who would be impressive to white people. And they didn't think that a dark-skinned teenager, low income, without a degree, could contribute. It's like reading an old English novel when you're the peasant and you're not recognized."
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes me think about, you know, everything that has, happened with Tyre Nichols recently and people's reactions of saying, well, you know, it can't be, you can't blame this on racism or white supremacism because mm-hmm. the police were Black. And it's like, no, those ideas still penetrate
mm-hmm.
way, yep. way, way, way deeper than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can still be an agent of it.
Absolutely. On May 6, 1955, Fred Gray went back to court to appeal Claudette's conviction. And this judge, Eugene Carter, ended up dropping the disturbing the peace and breaking the segregation law charges, but he kept the assaulting a police officer charge.
Which is just the most ridiculous
yeah,
of all.
It's the most ridiculous one. It's the most harmful one. And also, by dropping the segregation law, there was no precedent for them to then challenge the constitutionality of segregation laws mm-hmm. because she's now not convicted of it anymore. So
yeah. And now you've taken away all the context around the mm-hmm. What was it? Assaulting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now mm-hmm. she just, you know, on paper reads like someone who assaulted a police officer.
Yep. So we'll come back to Claudette a little bit later.
Okay.
But I do want to, you know, give a brief history of the Montgomery bus boycott to help kind of introduce our next heroine, because it was around this time where we are now that it really kicked off. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned earlier that Joanne Robinson, who was the leader of the WPC, had met with Montgomery Mayor W.A. Gale in March of 1954 to discuss changes that they wanted with the bus system. So they were mainly asking that Black passengers should not have to stand if there were available seats, even if those seats were in the white section. And that they shouldn't be forced to pay their fare and then exit the bus to re-enter through the back doors, because that's fucking stupid.
Yeah, maybe just let us get on the fucking bus and sit down and get to where we're going like every other person.
They were also asking to require buses to stop at every corner in black residential areas, just like they did in white communities. This obviously went over real well. Yeah, no. No policy was changed.
Everyone loved it. And
yes,
the end.
Yeah. Yeah. So the WPC was already interested in a bus boycott of some sort, but they were just waiting for the right spark. Claudette Colvin was apparently not it, nor was the arrest of another teenager just 7 months after Claudette, 18-year-old Mary Louise Smith, who was also arrested for refusing to give up her seat to a white passenger. It wasn't until Rosa Parks did the same and was arrested that the black community decided now was the time. So almost immediately after Rosa's arrest, Robinson and the WPC called for an official boycott of the buses starting December 5th, 1955. Robinson prepared a series of leaflets at Alabama State College and organized groups to distribute them throughout the black community. At the same time, Edie Nixon began gathering prominent black leaders such as Dr. King and Ralph Abernathy. So there's a picture of Joanne Robinson and Ralph Abernathy and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so they began setting up planning meetings at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, where they agreed to publicize the boycott. Mm-hmm. 90% of Montgomery's black residents avoided the buses on December 5th.
That's incredible.
They mobilized 90% of their community.
They didn't even have social media.
No! Like, it's amazing.
That's absolutely incredible.
Almost entirely because of Joanne Robinson and the WPC. Like, wow. Yeah. So black leaders gathered later that day to create the Montgomery Improvement Association, or the MIA, and Martin Luther King Jr., who was, again, just a 26-year-old pastor. he was chosen as the organization's president. Mm. During the meeting, the MIA voted to continue the boycott because it was so successful.
Wow.
King spoke to several thousand people at the meeting saying, quote, "I want it to be known that we're going to work with grim and bold determination to gain justice on the buses in this city. And we are not wrong. If we are wrong, the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. If we are wrong, the Constitution of the United States is wrong. If we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong."
Mm. Wow.
He could talk.
Yeah.
He can string some words together. My goodness.
Mm-hmm. So I have some things to say about the Supreme Court and the Constitution, though.
Yeah. Yep. Definitely wrong. So they also issued a list of formal demands, which was courteous treatment by bus operators, first come, first serve seating for all. And black bus operators on predominantly black routes, which, mm-hmm. So here's just a few pictures of the boycott. So it was just the entire black community refusing to ride the buses and walking to work and everywhere else that they had to go. Amazing.
Wow.
Just amazing. Wow. So our next heroine is my favorite. I love her so much. I can't wait. I originally wanted to do this whole episode on her, but there's sadly just not enough information, it's awful. But mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you what I could find out.
Yay.
So her name is Georgia Gilmore. Look at her.
Yes, Georgia.
I just want to hang out with her.
Yes.
she heard about the boycott over the radio. Georgia Gilmore, for some background, was born on February 5th, 1920, to Father Taylor Burns and Janie C. Gilmore in Montgomery, Alabama. She was one of seven children raised on a modest family farm with hogs, cows, and chickens, which she helped tend to when she was younger. Over the course of her life, Gilmore held jobs as a chef, a domestic helper, a midwife, and a railroad worker.
Damn.
I know. Accomplished. She raised her six children in Montgomery, supported her mother financially, and assisted in the upbringing of her youngest sister and a niece in the 1950s. So.
Okay. Jesus.
I know.
I literally spent half of the day complaining because I didn't sleep well last night.
Georgia loved to feed people, and she was well known for her amazing culinary skills. Apparently, her chicken was legendary. She worked as a cook at the National Cafe, which was a whites-only cafeteria in downtown Montgomery that catered to blue-collar workers. And because it was whites-only, Georgia had to remain unseen in the kitchen. She cooked all of the food and then placed it in a window where it was served by white waiters to other white customers, because of course. Georgia had also experienced poor treatment on the Montgomery buses. In one instance, the driver, you know, was following protocol, made her exit the bus after she paid her share to enter from the back doors, but drove away before she could get back on. So stole her money. So because of that incident, she had already been boycotting the buses for 2 months before the official boycott began.
Georgia was doing it before everyone else was.
Yes. So when she heard about the official boycott, she was very eager to get involved. She was already a member of the local NAACP, and so she began attending meetings of the MIA, where she introduced herself to Dr. King. Because of her involvement in this, though, she lost her job and was blacklisted from other white-owned restaurants in the city.
Wow.
But she was not deterred, of course not. With help from other MIA members, including Dr. King, who lived like right around the corner from her, she set up a makeshift home restaurant and used her culinary skills to literally feed the movement.
Oh my
God. Yes. She began preparing lunch at roughly 3 or 4 a.m. every morning. She had a variety of ham hocks, stuffed pork chops, potato salad, collard greens, candied yams, bread pudding, and black-eyed peas on her menu. And her menu changed daily. And by midday, her house was packed with patrons, many of whom waited an hour or longer just to place their orders. And everyone else had to eat standing up in the living room or the kitchen because only about a dozen people could fit in her dining room table. So, yeah, she has a home restaurant and she's thriving.
I know I've mentioned this podcast before, but there's a podcast called Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. And in each episode, they pick like a character to bless. And one of the blessings that I loved, it's from a super old episode, but they talk about blessing Molly Weasley for feeding the Order of the Phoenix and how underappreciated and underacknowledged that goes in so many situations like this is just the act of feeding everyone.
Absolutely. Yes. It's just, it's so important. Mm-hmm. It's nourishing in more ways than just like physical.
Absolutely. So, yes.
Yeah.
And no one else is thinking about it.
Right.
Come on.
Someone's got to do it.
Yes.
So, of course, during the boycott, the Black community was not riding the city buses, but they still had to get to work and to school. And the majority did not own cars. Plus, the city began to penalize Black taxi drivers for giving rides to boycotters. And so organizers set up very intricate carpool systems of about 300 cars, but that required extra gas money. So Georgia, who had already been bringing her famous fried chicken sandwiches to MIA meetings, organized Black women to sell pound cakes and sweet potato pies, fried fish and stewed greens, pork chops and rice at beauty salons, cab stands, and churches.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Author, she's just organizing everyone, getting it done. Author John T. Edge said, quote, "She offered these women, many of whose grandmothers were born into slavery, a way to contribute to the cause that would not raise suspicions of white employers who might fire them from their jobs or white landowners who might evict them from the houses they rented." Hmm. And to further make sure that these women would be kind of anonymous or protected as much as they wanted to be, she called them the Club from Nowhere. Her sister Betsy said that another reason for the name of the club was because, quote, "It was like, where did this money come from? It came from nowhere."
Yes.
So during the 381-day boycott, so they did this for over a year.
Without Gilmore, social media. I can't get over this.
Without social media. Like, there's no Uber. There is no...
Yes. Yes. There is no group text figuring out who's picking up who where.
No. No. Oh, it's amazing. And Georgia's cooking helped pay for insurance, gas, wagons, vehicle repairs, and she just kept the carpool system going with her financial contributions.
Incredible.
I know. The Club from Nowhere typically raised about $125 to $200 each week, which today is the equivalent of about $1,100 to $1,800.
Wow.
And Georgia is believed to have raised more money for the boycott than any other person in Montgomery.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Just from selling her food.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Throughout the course of the boycott, Georgia became a very close confidant of Dr. King. They lived just a few houses down from one another, and according to Dr. King's barber, quote, "Whenever VIPs would come to town, he would always have Miss Gilmore cook up a batch of chicken." Aww. And then I am going to show this next picture. It's not the most flattering picture of Dr. King, but it is literally a picture of him eating George's chicken. So.
Worth it. Yes.
Like, literally eating her chicken. Oh. It's credited. He's eating her chicken. Aww. And there's Georgia cutting into a really yummy looking pound cake.
Yeah.
And after Dr. King's house was bombed, he would often host important guests or hold meetings at Georgia's house. Mm. So her house kind of became the clubhouse of the movement. She even cooked for and hosted Robert F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson.
Wow.
Yeah. In February of 1956, a Montgomery County grand jury indicted Dr. King and 89 other boycott leaders, claiming that they violated a 1921 statute that outlawed boycotts against businesses.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So they took him to court in state of Alabama versus King. It was a 4-day trial led by lawyer Fred Gray. So he's back. Georgia was one of 31 witnesses in outlining the years of mistreatment by African Americans on Montgomery buses. So Fred Gray was really using this one to help kind of promote that, you know, these segregated laws were completely unconstitutional.
Yeah, like not only are you going to say we can't boycott, but you're going to say that, like, we can't, like, the buses themselves are just a horrible fucking experience for us.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Make it make sense.
It can't.
You must use this terrible system.
So, in her testimony, in her testimony, Georgia described the incident where the driver drove away after she had already paid. And she said she didn't know his name, but that she could describe him and that she would know him if She, quote, "I would know him if I saw him. He is tall. He has red hair and freckles and wears glasses. He's a very nasty bus driver."
Yes. You remember people who are shitty to you. You don't forget their faces.
Yes. On the final day of the trial, Judge Eugene W. Carter found King guilty and fined him $500 plus an additional $500 for court costs. And that was back then money. So that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Rather than pay the fine, King chose to appeal the verdict. And so his sentence was converted to 386 days of jail time. Mm. Responding to the verdict, King said, quote, "I was optimistic enough to hope for the best, but realistic enough to prepare for the worst. This will not mar or diminish in any way my interest in the protest. We will continue to protest in the same spirit of nonviolence and passive resistance using the weapon of love." The Court of Appeals rejected King's appeal on April 30th, 1957, maintaining that his lawyers missed the 60-day deadline. And so King paid the fine in December of 1957. In February of 1956, Fred Gray and Charles Langford filed a lawsuit on behalf of four women: Aurelia S. Browder, Susie McDonald, Claudette Colvin, and Marie Louise Smith for their mistreatment on city buses. The NAACP and Thurgood Marshall also assisted on the case that challenged the constitutionality of the laws requiring segregation on buses. The suit was brought before a 3-judge U.S. District Court panel, and during the court case, Colvin described her arrest. Quote, "I kept saying, he has no civil right. This is my constitutional right. You have no right to do this. And I just kept blabbing things out and I never stopped. That was worse than stealing, you know, talking back to a white person." Mm-hmm. On June 5th, 1956, 2 of the 3 judges ruled that segregation on Alabama's city buses was unconstitutional.
Wow.
State and local officials appealed, sending the case to the Supreme Court, but they affirmed the circuit court's decision. And on December 20th, 1956.
We wish.
The court ordered Montgomery and the entire state of Alabama to end bus segregation permanently.
Wow.
So it was that Claudette's, you know, lawsuit with the other 4 women that completely ended segregation on Montgomery buses.
That's incredible. Which in turn then just led to the toppling of all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. King called for an end to the boycott, and the very next morning he boarded an integrated bus with Ralph Abernathy, Edie Dixon, and Glenn Smiley. King said, quote, "We came to see that in the long run, it is more honorable to walk in dignity than ride in humiliation. So we decided to substitute tired feet for tired souls and walk the streets of Montgomery."
Wow.
Claudette gave birth to a son named Raymond in March of 1956. And then she moved to New York City in 1958 due to difficulty in finding work after her political involvement. I mean, after all, segregation was now against the law in Montgomery, but the white people were not happy about it. Bus stops were still segregated, and so snipers began firing into buses.
Jesus Christ.
Black churches and homes of black leaders were bombed by members of the KKK, and so she left the South. She gave birth to another son in 1960, and she worked as a nurse's aide in a nursing home for 35 years before retiring in 2004. Her family has fought for her rightful place in history. In 2016, the Smithsonian Institute and its National Museum of African American History and Culture were challenged by Colvin and her family, who asked that she be given a more prominent mention in the history of the civil rights movement, as she deserves.
Mm-hmm.
And Colvin was not invited officially for the formal dedication of the museum.
Dang.
Yeah.
That's cold.
I know. Claudette's sister, Gloria, said, "All we want is the truth. Why does history fail to get it right? Had it not been for Claudette Colvin or Browder or McDonald or Mary Louise Smith, there may not have been a Thurgood Marshall, a Martin Luther King Jr., or a Rosa Parks." Mm-hmm. Which is very true.
Very true.
In 2021, Claudette applied to the family court in Montgomery County, Alabama, to have her juvenile record expunged. Daryl Bailey, the district attorney for the county, supported her motion, stating, quote, "Her actions back in March of 1955 were conscientious, not criminal, inspired, not illegal. They should have led to praise and not persecution." And the judge ordered that the juvenile record be expunged and destroyed in December of 2021.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's her with the district attorney.
She still looks the same.
I know. I know. Look at her. So the judge stated that Colvin's refusal had been recognized as a courageous act on her behalf and on behalf of a community of affected people. As for Georgia, she continued to feed people and stand up for civil rights. In 1959, her son, Mark, was arrested and beaten by two white police officers for taking a shortcut through a whites-only park. Georgia sued the city, fighting the charges against her son on the basis that segregated parks were unconstitutional, according to the 14th Amendment, and she won.
Wow.
But, you know, in typical two-year-old logic, the city of Montgomery just closed the parks rather than integrate them.
Yep. That's exactly what a toddler would do.
100%. Georgia also provided a safe haven for freedom riders. You know, those were riding interstate buses into southern states to help integrate them. Mm-hmm. And she sheltered them and fed them until it was safe for them to leave.
Wow.
Oh.
Just come in. I'll take care of you and feed you.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Amazing. On March 7th, 1990, Georgia woke up early to start preparing food for the 25th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March, even though she had been advised by her doctor to take it easy. And Georgia passed away that day doing what she loved. And her family was able to serve the food that she had prepared for those who came to mourn her.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. Her sister Betty said, "Lots of people brought food to the house too, but everyone ate George's chicken and potato salad first. Nobody could fix it better."
Oh.
Yeah, and that is what I know about some of the amazing women of the Montgomery bus boycott.
Yay! That was so good. Oh, so good.
I love them.
Oh, yes. It's very difficult, some of it.
Yes.
To hear, yeah. But important. Yeah. And yeah. Wow.
All right. I do have some recommendations, but I do want to say right off the bat, it was really hard to find fiction. Which I found very interesting.
Yeah, I would not have.
Yeah. So if you all out there have some recommendations on some fiction set during this exact time period or about the bus boycott, that'd be great. I found just a few that take place, you know, in the South during this time. Mm-hmm. But I do have a lot of nonfiction, so we're going to go there first. The very first book is what kind of started me in this rabbit hole. This one I got from the Cardinal Cup. But it's It's called Sweet Justice, Georgia Gilmore and the Montgomery Bus Boycott by Mara Rockliffe. Here is the vibrant true story of a hidden figure of the civil rights movement told in flavorful language by a picture book master and stunningly illustrated by a Caldecott Honor recipient and 7-time Coretta Scott King Award winning artist R. Gregory Christie. This book is beautiful. Mm-hmm. Highly, highly recommend. It's a beautiful picture book. The next one is The Potlucker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South by John T. Edge. The Potlucker Papers is a people's history of the modern South told through its food. Beginning with the pivotal role cooks and waiters played in the civil rights movement, noted authority John T. Edge narrates the South's fitful journey from a hive of racism to a hotbed of American immigration. He shows why working-class Southern food has become a vital driver of contemporary American cuisine. Along the way, Edge profiles extraordinary figures in Southern food, including Georgia Gilmore, Fannie Lou Hamer, Colonel Sanders, Mahalia Jackson, Edna Lewis, Paul Prudhomme, Craig Claiborne, and Sean Brock. The Potlucker Papers reveals how Southern food has become a shared culinary language for the nation. So that one sounds real fun.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. I love food history.
Yes. Yeah. This next one is also about food. This one is called Feed the Resistance, Recipes and Ideas for Getting Involved by Julia Tertian. From favorite cookbook author Julia Tertian comes this practical and inspiring handbook for political activism with recipes. Mm-hmm. As the millions who marched in January 2017 demonstrated, activism is the new normal. When people search for ways to resist injustice and express support for civil rights, environmental protections, and more, they begin by gathering around a table to talk and plan. These dishes foster community and provide sustenance for the mind and soul, including a dozen of the healthy, affordable recipes Tertian is known for, plus over 15 more recipes from a diverse range of celebrated chefs. With stimulating lists, extensive resources, and essays from activists in the world of food, politics, and social causes, Feed the Resistance is a must-have handbook for anyone hoping to make a difference.
Wow.
And the proceeds for this one is supposed to go to the ACLU, so.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Next, this one is The Montgomery Bus Boycott and the Women Who Started It, the memoir of Joanne Gibson Robinson. Mm-hmm. So the Montgomery Bus Boycott, which ignited the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, has always been vitally important in Southern and Black history. With the publication of this book, the boycott becomes a milestone in the history of American women as well. Coretta Scott King said, quote, "This valuable firsthand account of the historic Montgomery Bus Boycott, written by an important behind-the-scenes organizer, evokes the emotional intensity of the civil rights struggle. It ought to be required reading for all Americans who value their freedom and the contribution of Black women to our history." Okay, so next we have Streetcar to Justice, How Elizabeth Jennings Won the Right to Ride in New York. This is by Amy Hill Hirth. I have a lot of children's fiction in here. This is another juvenile fiction. Best-selling author and journalist Amy Hill Hirth uncovers the story of a little-known figure in U.S. history in this fascinating biography. And it's all about Elizabeth Jennings. And then we have Claudette Colvin, Twice Towards Justice by Philip Hughes. Based on extensive interviews with Claudette Colvin and many others, Philip Hughes presents the first in-depth account of a major yet little-known civil rights figure whose story provides a fresh perspective on the Montgomery Bus Boycott of 1955 to 56. Historic figures like Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks play important roles, but center stage belongs to the brave, bookish girl whose two acts of courage were to affect the course of American history. It's a really great read. I loved this book. I got almost all of my information about Claudette from this book. Plus, it won the National Book Award, and it was a Newbery Honor. So,
oh, great.
It's good.
Yes.
So here's the little history or fiction that I could find. The first is The Invincible Summer of Juniper Jones by Daveen McQuinn. It's the summer of 1955. For Ethan Harper, a biracial kid raised mostly by his white father, race has always been a distant conversation. When he's sent to spend the summer with his aunt and uncle in small town Alabama, his blackness is suddenly front and center, and no one is shy about making it known he's not welcome there. Enter Juniper Jones, the town's resident oddball and free spirit. She's everything the townspeople aren't: open, kind, and accepting. Armed with two bikes and an unlimited supply of root beer floats, Ethan and Juniper set out to find their place in a town that's bent on rejecting them. As Ethan is confronted for the first time about what it means to be black in America, Juniper tries to help him see the beauty in even the ugliest reality, and that even the darkest days can rise to an invincible summer. It just sounds good.
It does. It's super sweet.
Yes. And then this, so that's a YA book. This one is juvenile fiction, or middle grade. Walking to the Bus Rider Blues by Harriet Gillum Robinette. And this is during the Alabama bus boycott, 6 months after Rosa Parks made her famous bus protest. Alpha Merrifield and his family struggle to pay the rent. But someone keeps stealing their rent money, and now someone is accusing them of stealing. With only a few days left before rent is due, Alpha and his sister Zinnia know they don't have much time. To solve this mystery, they must walk the walk and talk the talk of nonviolence that Martin Luther King Jr. and other leaders preach. And what they discover may be more than they dreamed. And then the last recommendation is a series of books. This is The Logan Family Saga by Mildred Taylor. This includes Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, which I'm sure most of us had to read in school. Mm-hmm. It follows the Logans, who is a tight-knit family who grapple with living in America during the 20th century. We follow the family as they experience prejudice, racism, and the major events that characterize our modern racial history. From the Great Depression to the Civil Rights Movement, this gripping series will both educate and capture the hearts of all readers as they read about how Cassie Logan finds her voice in an era characterized by oppression and the often violent confrontations that bring about change.
Woo.
So, yeah, those are all of my recommendations.
Great.
Yeah. And I have a whole bunch of sources for this, so if you're interested in reading a whole bunch of articles, I will list those.
Well, thank you so much for teaching me about these amazing women.
So I just wish I could have been George's friend. Do you have a review for us?
I believe I do. Okay, so my new technique for finding book reviews is just to look at like one of the books that we talk about.
Yes.
And go to the one-star reviews.
Yep. Yep.
So this is a one-star review for Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow.
Okay.
From Amazon. 1 out of 5 stars. The title of the review is Pop Trash. Okay, so the review says, I don't get it. This book is worse than 50 Shades, and I'm not kidding. Not possible.
No.
Let me try a sentence. Would you be interested if I said, this book is sprelumptuous, I said out loud, realizing the year was 1995 as I passed a man wearing a vermilion macrame hat. Do you think that's good writing? If so, you'll love Tomorrow. Personally, I don't get it at all. In the olden days, we called this using a $2 word where a 10-cent word would do, owing to days when mass market writers were paid by how many pages they could fill up. The author constantly uses gigantic words which aren't even properly placed. I'm sure half the people reading just assume she's a genius and nobody knows enough to call her on it. Yeah, definitely didn't get past, you know, rounds of editing.
Right.
Oh, as someone who knows some of these words, it feels like she intentionally wrote in a manner where she had to go back and grab a thesaurus. Oh. I'm a programmer, oh, and trust me, this isn't how programming or gaming works. She can't even write from a male perspective, he said as he noticed the exact shade of crimson red on her hand-woven alpaca sweater, which is probably on sale at the department stores at this time of year in 1995, a set of facts a male programmer in college in 1995 would definitely be aware of. Did I mention it's 1995? Because it's 1995. So that means you like my review because it's set in 1995. That's how writing works, right?
Oh.
I can't figure out what the characters are supposed to be. They're seemingly fashion obsessed as the author is pointing out every fabric and shade they pass by on the street. I did not remember this happening at all. But the character is seemingly being described as autistic, saying things like sex is like a video game, which isn't sexy at all. It's just weird. And the lead boy and girl have an easygoing, fluent, verbal, and physical conversation. So these are seemingly autistic nerds in school for programming who are very verbally eloquent and fashion obsessed and written up from a female perspective, regardless of gender. Like it's impossible for someone with autism to be well-spoken.
Oh, yeah. Totally impossible.
And this is the book of the year? Ugh, I'm sorry. Maybe everyone has like a chip in their head and I don't. So I didn't get the software update. I couldn't make it past the first page without my head physically aching from how awful the writing was. I'm going to go and read an actual programming manual to wash this out of my brain.
Oh. Your misogyny is showing, my friend.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I have, okay, so I have one more about the same book and I just had to include it because it just made me laugh. It's super short. But it just says, bought this because it was in Jimmy Fallon's book club. I couldn't get into it. Beginning didn't engage me, so I didn't read the rest. So this review may not be fair. Did you know that Jimmy Fallon had a book club?
Did not know Jimmy Fallon had a book club. Amazing.
Never thought that I would read that in a book review. Bought this because it was... It was in Jimmy Fallon's book club.
Sought it out. Oh my.
How about you?
Yeah, so I kind of did the exact same thing. So this... is a 1-star review of Feed the Resistance, the recipe book.
Okay.
This says, I can't wait to read the cookbook written by pro-lifers, NRA members, and proponents of freedom of speech. Oh, yeah, that would never happen.
Oh, my God.
Just look at all of the Duck Dynasty books.
Oh, my God.
Another miserable product of the identity politics crowd who bank on their own misery index. The recipes here don't even look good, so I did not bother trying them. Go get a Big Mac for Chris's sakes.
Yeah, well,
yep.
Mm-hmm. Chris likes his Big Macs.
Like, why?
Oh, my God.
I love how they mention that they, you know, want to read about someone who proponents freedom of speech.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you don't want anybody else to talk. that's okay. Great.
Uh-huh. Right. And acts like there isn't enough content written from like a conservative point of view.
I mean, there's just plenty of that.
So underrepresented.
Oh, poor you.
Oh, goodness. Oh boy.
Yeah. Okay. I just moved my whole computer. Okay. Great.
Oh, that was so great. I loved it. I loved how you just combined them all because I've had so many topics and people like that I've looked at and I'm like, there isn't enough to do a whole episode.
Yeah.
So it's a really good idea. Because they still deserve to have their stories told.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's sad that there's not enough written. Mm-hmm. I will say there is, and I'll link it in the show notes. I use it as one of my sources, a full interview. I think in the 80s with Georgia Gilmore talking about all of her experiences. So there's the video and the transcript. So definitely worth a look at.
Yeah, I definitely want to listen to her.
Yeah. Yeah. Yay.
All right. Well.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to The Reference Desk.
If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
If you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/thereferencedesk.
And if you're interested in purchasing any of the books we discussed today, visit our bookshop storefront at bookshop.org/thereferencedeskpod.
You can find us on Instagram at thereferencedeskpod. Visit our website at thereferencedeskpod.com or drop us an email at referencedeskpod@gmail.com.
This episode was written and produced by us.
Our music is C'est Salavi by Eric Harper, and our cover art for the show is by Maria Amaya.
Until next week, we'll see you in the stacks.